Before we get started, I want to let you know that our guest's audio starts off a little bit rough, but it gets a lot better about 15 minutes in. No need to adjust your headphones. It's not you, it's us. Now buckle up and let's get started.
The following is a quarantine recording presented to you in Around Sound.
It was recorded with whatever was lying around.
Lady, don't take no shit. Insist on respect the sister. Walk around like a womanish. She won't speak unless it's something worth saying. Don't play. The girl take herself so serious. Like, people stare curious. Like, she got a natural way. Her hips sway furious. Like, yeah, the luxurious. Like, carries herself like the cutest, most prettiest thing you've seen this side of the bay.
Hey, this is Lady Don't Take No, your weekly roundup of all of the real and none of the fake. I'm your host, Alicia Garza. This show is pro-Black, pro-queer, proudly feminist, and pro-do what you like. Every week, you're going to get the best of what goes on in my head and what we're loving on and hating on, what we might be and what we ain't going to do. Politics, pop culture, what inspires my meme game, we cover it all. We are recording from Oakland, California, the center of the known universe, where we are all on Rona lockdown. It's a weird time, a scary time. It's all the kinds of time, but don't worry. We're going to help you pass the time every single week. So be sure to tune in, tell a friend, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. We do it for the culture. So the pod is free 99 because we know that stimulus check, it's got to last.
It's all right. It's all right now. I look right in your eyes, ask how'd you get so neat?
How'd you get so neat?
My guest this week is the president of Color of Change, a leading racial justice organization with more than 1.4 million members. He designs winning strategies to build power for Black communities. His work has been instrumental in moving prosecutors to reduce mass incarceration and police violence, forcing corporations to stop supporting Trump initiatives and white nationalists, winning net neutrality as a civil rights issue, changing representations of race in Hollywood, and forcing Bill O'Reilly off the air. There is no end to this man's good work. He writes a monthly column about race, politics, and corporate accountability for The Guardian, and his name is Rashad Robinson. Hey, Rashad.
Hey, baby. How you doing? Good to see you. Well, be with you. Not see you, but hear you.
All the things. All the things. I'm omniscient? Whatever the fuck. I'm everywhere, so you can see me, you can hear me, you can feel
me. Omnipotent, right? Omnipotent. That's what you was looking for, I think.
I think so, maybe. Yeah, okay, anyways. Yeah. Thank you, boo.
Omnipresent.
That's the word I was looking for, omnipresent. So I am so excited to have one of my bestest friends on the pod today. I call him Mr. Robinson, otherwise known as my second bae. And before y'all go on and try to tell Malachi what I said, he already knows, he co-signs, and he agrees, so mind your business. Baby, we are going to talk about all your fabulous work and leadership today, but we got to get some things out the way first. So you and I met a long time ago in a different place, in a different time, but we actually didn't become for real friends until we had a meeting of the minds and a meeting of the hearts over some drinks in the town. You have given me a line that I am forever waiting to use in the most excellent and appropriate way. So give us the scoop, Rashad. How do you stay focused on what you have to do and not get pulled down into somebody else's quicksand? And I know you know what I'm talking about.
So, you know, people always want to pull you into their stuff, take time that you don't actually have, make demands that they, you know, haven't yet earned from you, or just in general, people have their own priorities. And if you could wake up one day and be on somebody else's time. And so I do like to think about not getting caught in a rabbit hole. And, you know, when we first met, you know, we met, I was like, you know, we're on a panel. You gave a speech. I was on the panel. I was like, she seems great. But shortly after that, you had followed up with this email introducing me to somebody that I had already decided that I did not really want to keep engaging with. And you connected them. You didn't check in with me first. You connected me to the person. And I was like, I don't really even know this sister yet. And she's already like pointing me towards who I should be in contact with.
Exactly. I was trying to bring you in.
I just decided that, you know, that this was not something that I needed to respond to. And I just decided that the best way was, instead of taking a lot of time responding or trying to figure things out, I would just let it die. I was like, I don't know when I'm going to see this sister next. And I think you followed up again.
I think I followed up a couple times.
And then the second time I was like, huh, she clearly doesn't get the fact that I'm not trying to talk to this person. Maybe she thinks I don't get the email. I got the email. And, you know, I do have this thing that I oftentimes do where if someone sends me something, this is oftentimes if someone sends me something where I feel like they have taken liberties, they're talking out the side of their neck in a way that they haven't earned.
Otherwise called out of pocket.
Yeah, that they are sort of out of pocket. I will oftentimes, I don't like to get angry and back and forth. I like to preserve my sanity in my day to day. And so, and also not give them a paper trail that has me looking like angry black man. And so I will oftentimes respond with something like, and so if you're listening and you've gotten one of these emails from me, cat's out the bag. What I will say is, I think you sent this to me by mistake. And I'll say nothing else. And oftentimes what I think this does for people who have like decided they're going to come at me or come for something or engage in a way that's probably inappropriate or they haven't yet earned, I think what oftentimes it forces them to do is have to think, what do you mean? What does he mean by mistake? This wasn't a mistake. Why is he saying this? And then I put the energy back on them. And what I don't do, and whether or not they respond or don't respond, and oftentimes most people don't respond. Most people take a step back, think about what they were originally like, were sending, because email sometimes make people bigger than they really are. Uh-huh. They make people stronger and more powerful than they really are. They make people badder and more fierce than they really are. And what I like to do is give people a second to pause and reflect.
This is your favorite to humanity.
Yes, it's my favorite to humanity. Let's lower the volume a little bit so that you can actually hear yourself. And once you hear yourself and you read yourself, maybe you will make the decision to pivot and move forward. So I don't have to pivot for you. Because the I think you sent this to me by mistake is actually my favor to you. It's giving you, because mistakes are things that we all make. And I'm giving you an option to say, yes, Rashad, I sent this to you by mistake. And then you can hit pause and then we can move forward. And what I like to think of is the spirit of cooperation and understanding. For you, though, you just kept sending the email. And then you decided that you didn't like me for some reason because I...
Correct, because you didn't respond to me knowing good and damn well you got my emails.
I did get your emails, but you also sent those emails to me under bad pretenses. Because what you and I both know is that you knew that the person you were trying to put me in touch with was a person that, you know...
You actually didn't need to be in touch with them. You're correct.
That I didn't need to be in touch with, right? And so had I known that at the time, had you reached out to me on the side and said, hey, do you need to be in touch? We could have had a whole conversation. Now, had I not responded to that email, I would have been wrong.
And then I would have had the right to be tight.
And you'd have the right to be tight. But what I didn't respond to was you making an introduction. Now, right now, we know each other. We've known each other for a while. We are simpatico in so many ways. I'm just going to trust on faith that if you're going to put me in contact with someone over email, that like, it's vetted, it's good, I'm going to respond, right? But back then, we actually didn't really know each other. And so all I could think was like, huh, this sister is like putting me in contact with someone that I've already decided I don't want to be in contact with. Maybe this person is in cahoots with that person. Maybe I don't want to be in contact with them either. We all have to do the things to preserve our sanity in a crazy world. And that is how, you know, how we make it work.
So hopefully for those of you who are listening right now, you are grabbing three core things. Number one, I love this man so much. And honestly, he's not wrong. First of all, don't be giving out people's contact information without asking them first. And this is actually where I learned this lesson in a really good way. Number two, don't get caught up in other people's stuff. Quite frankly, you know, if it's not your priority, you don't have to feel pressed to respond. Although if this is somebody who is a friend, definitely hit them up on the side and be like, girl, now you know good and damn well I'm not trying to be in touch. I need you to cease and desist. Number three, this is actually the story that precipitated the deep love and friendship that Rashad and I have together. So
it's also a moral of the story is that anything is possible, right? Because we started off, I started off being like, she is connected to some folks that I don't really want to feature, that I don't really want to be involved with.
This was me in another life, y'all. This was me in another
life. Like, yeah, like maybe we don't. And you were like, Rashad is shady. Rashad thinks he's too cool for school. Rashad doesn't respond to emails, and I don't know who he thinks he is.
I was following through on a commitment that I made. So for those people who are listening, you should know that I really do work hard. And if you have asked me to roll for you on something and you are my peoples, I'm going to roll. And Rashad can attest to this.
I can attest to it, much to your detriment.
Because he was on the opposite end of it.
Yes. And the moral of the story is that for people who are listening, your commitments are not my commitments.
Now that is a word and a half. You're an excellent cook, and I owe at least 5 of the pounds that I'm carrying around right now to fried chicken sandwiches with your famous coleslaw, your apple cakes, and the like. What is your favorite thing to cook now that the Rona has got us on stay-at-home orders?
So a couple of things. So it's getting warm, so I'm shifting a little bit because, like, when the Rona first hit, we were, like, in the March area where it was still kind of cold outside, and I was in the sort of stews and the curries, the things where you can layer in flavors over time and really make things work. So I like to try, like, spins on things, like taking a Thai curry and making the, like, good curry from scratch, or making a good paste from scratch and then taking and, you know, frying up some meats or chicken or fish and then pouring it over and with some rice. I love, like, mixing different cultures and different foods. I'm really into, like, fresh produce and but I will say the things that I have been really enjoying is I'm just around a lot of seafood. I was living in the city. There's a fish market, farmer's fish market, that where the fish actually comes from Eastern Long Island. And they come in the morning and they sell the fish. And I have been doing all sorts of things with, like, scallops and flounder and mussels and clams and oysters. And it's been just really wonderful to cook, and probably cooking a lot of food that is a mixture of sort of French New Orleans style and sort of Asian styles of cooking. And that's like, you know, Thai, Chinese in particular when I, you know, talk about East Asian cuisine. I also have been enjoying watching everybody else's food on social media in a way that I really haven't enjoyed. Some people are just doing some really incredible stuff, like with their food and sharing recipes. And I'm like, that person's really doing well. And some people really need a lot of help. And they've been posting things that make me feel like they don't have good friends. Like, they don't have that friend that picks them up and calls them and says, you know, I've eaten your food and it's not really good. Or maybe your food is good, but you don't take good pictures of it and you don't have good lighting. Or it's both. And whatever those situations are, I'm seeing a lot of these things on social media. And I believe that over time, that might be the thing that I can help with over time.
Listen.
Whether it's lighting advice or whether it is advice simply on seasoning and cooking your chicken all the way through. Because I believe that there are some folks that are serving pink chicken, and I worry about them when, you know, if medical institutions are not open up the way they used to be.
We 100% had this conversation on the first episode of our pod. Latifah and I had a whole segment on struggle plates.
There's an African-American tragedy that appears every single time that I turn on the book, go on Twitter. It's shocking.
And I'm really happy to hear that you two have been witnessing some of the struggle of our loved ones who are trying to get used to being home and needing to cook. But in the meantime, why don't we shout out some of our people who can help our brethren, right? Get a little bit better with these lighted photos or even just the recipes with the food cooked through all the way. And when you were talking just now, I was thinking about our dear friend, Tracy Sturdivant.
Yes, Mother Sturdivant. She's killing it.
Who has been cooking her ass off and posting the recipes in the comments so that you too can follow along. So I don't know if her page is open or not, but if you know Sister Sturdivant, reach out to her and ask her for an ad, honey, because you will not be disappointed. Let's pivot and talk a little bit about your work. You're the president of Color of Change, an organization that I am so proud to be a board member of and just an overall super fan. I joined Color of Change about 105 years ago, and I got me a t-shirt that said George Bush don't care about black people. Can you tell the people who are listening right now, what was that all about? I know it's a part of the origin story of Color of Change. Tell the people, how did Color of Change come to be, and why do we need an organization like Color of Change in our lives?
You know, Color of Change was founded after Hurricane Katrina, which was a flood that was caused by bad decision makers, and it turned into a life-altering disaster by bad decision makers. And so really, Color of Change was founded as a new type of infrastructure to channel the aspirations, outrage, passions of Black folks and allies of every race to hold government and corporations accountable, to create a more human and less hostile world for Black people and all people. Because the thing about Katrina that was so clear is that while so many things that we already knew were taking place, the impacts of geographic segregation and generational poverty and what we've done to systems like our criminal justice and education and so much more, at the heart of Katrina, no one was nervous about disappointing Black people. And when institutions are not nervous about disappointing your community, you need power, you need a campaign, you need the ability to hold those in office accountable and sometimes kick them out of office. And so right after that telethon where Kanye West and went out there with Mike Myers and said, George Bush doesn't care about Black people, the first email from Color of Change went out, losing, you know, what was the new organizing technology at the time, which was email that people were using in groups like Move On and others, but we really didn't have a vehicle for it in the racial justice space. And so using email to about 1,000 people that said Kanye was right in the subject line. And of course, we've got these t-shirts that say Kanye was right as well, that, you know, depending on what day of the week you wear those t-shirts, and more importantly, depending on kind of more recently, I should say, any day of the week that you're wearing those t-shirts, people could look at you a little crazy asking you what you think Kanye was right about. But at the time, Kanye was absolutely right about George Bush not caring about Black people. And that was the birth of Color of Change. And since then, we have grown to a movement of over 1.7 million Black folks and their allies of every race. In fact, 1.7 million people have taken action with Color of Change just in the last 8 months alone. And you know, all of this is about building a powerful force in the 21st century to ensure that Black people are not just present, but powerful, that Black people are able to hold corporations accountable, hold government accountable, and get them to do things that they wouldn't otherwise want to do.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. You've often said, Rashad, that presence is not power. And with these recent murders, that statement could not be more true. So tell us what you mean there. And also, what does it look like for Black people to have real power in this country?
Yeah, you know, what I mean when I talk about presence isn't power, like, I'm not against presence, but I think far too often we mistake visibility and awareness. Retweets, shout outs from the stage, Black faces in high places as sort of the end result of our work. We will sometimes praise the fact that some of us have had breakthrough achievements in the sort of celebration of Black History Month and the stamps and all that stuff is like true progress, while we watch the data and the numbers actually tell a very different story about our progress, right? Mm-hmm. Since 1980, we have seen Black and white wealth income disparities grow. We have seen our schools become more segregated. We have seen attacks on Black home ownership, Black businesses. We have seen so many ways in which disparities have continued to driven a story while we celebrate these sort of individual victories. And so a Black president doesn't mean that we have become post-racial. In fact, it can mean, very much mean, that Black faces can help alleviate people's guilt or feeling like they have to do something. Black pop star, Black celebrities that America celebrates doesn't mean that America loves Black people. In fact, America can love Black culture and hate Black people at the same time. And in fact, they don't have to actually operate against one another. They can operate in unison to create the same type of story and impact. And so what I mean by presence and power is us not mistaking presence and visibility for power. Power is the ability to change the rules. And when we have the ability to change the rules, whether they are the written rules of policy or whether they're the unwritten rules of culture, how corporations treat us, how schools treat our children, how hospitals treat us when we go inside, all of these sort of unwritten rules outside of what is legislative, when that changes, that's when we know that we have power. Black businesses, we have seen so many ways in which disparities have continued to driven a story while we celebrate these sort of individual victories.
You know, part of changing the rules is about changing the stories that we tell about why things are the way they are and what we can do about it. I know that you all just put out a guide to how we can tell different stories in this really treacherous and precarious moment of being in the midst of a global health pandemic, a crisis in democracy, and a looming economic crisis. So tell us about the narrative work that Color of Change is doing, and tell me your perspective on what kinds of stories we need to be telling right now in order to help change the rules.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, we think a lot about narrative. We think about it in terms of power, right? In terms of shifting the demands for the type of results and the type of interventions that we need, reducing the demand or the push for quote-unquote solutions that are only going to put us in harm's way. And far too often, we even inside of progressive civil rights circles don't tell the stories that actually lead us to the results. Far too often, we talk about inequality is unfortunate, almost like a car accident. We talk about it as it sort of just happened, whether it's through the stories we tell or sort of how we talk about sort of the bootstrap mythology about hard work getting us out of it, right? We sometimes blame people for the circumstances that we're in. We deny people education, then blame people for not being educated. We deny people access to healthcare, then blame people for being unhealthy. We deny people access to quality, healthy food, and then blame people for not eating well. All those things are part of the sort of ways in which when we look at inequality as unfortunate rather than unjust, we let off the hook those who have manufactured inequality, those who benefit from inequality being in place. We oftentimes also tell a story where systems that have put Black people in harm's way end up being talked about in passive ways, and Black people and oppressed people more broadly get talked about in active ways. And so we will say, Black people are less likely to get a loan from a bank. Instead of, banks are more likely to exclude Black people from a loan. On one hand, you make Black people the problem. On the other hand, you actually rightly put the onus on the banks, who have for years excluded Black people from the same gifts and opportunities that the rest of society have access to. What this ends up happening, right, is that then people, when we tell the story the wrong way, that we get the wrong set of solutions. And so if you make the story about Black kids not graduating at the same rate as white kids, instead of schools failing to educate and serve Black students, then we have people trying to fix Black families, Black people. We have people trying to fix those who are oppressed instead of dismantling the oppression. And the kind of charitable solutions to structural problems is a long-term challenge that we have, because what it gets us is it gets people outraged by the criminal justice system and just thinking about reentry programs or you know, programs to build manhood among Black men, instead of actually looking at all the ways that people have been exploited and attacked. Because at the end of the day, part of these challenges is that we like to put personality traits on people facing systems instead of actually dealing with the systems. And so every time we say that Black people are vulnerable, vulnerability is a personality trait. You know, I've felt vulnerable when I've been dumped. I've felt vulnerable, you know, after eating too much fried chicken and like not knowing why I ate all that food. I felt vulnerable.
He said, hold me.
You know, I'm like, just hold me. Why did I do that to myself? I felt vulnerable after watching a movie that sort of like hit me the wrong way. And I was like, damn, they were really telling my story. And yes, and in that situation, I need to pull it together. The Black people are not vulnerable. Black people have been attacked, exploited, targeted. Black communities have been fleeced. All of those things are what we should be concentrating on. And far too often we have lawmakers, we have policymakers that want to avoid doing their jobs, want to avoid enacting policies and changing practices. And so instead they focus on how the people who are at the receiving end of the pain can fix themselves so that the system doesn't actually have to realign or change, so that the winners can keep winning and those who have been targeted, those who have been exploited, and as a result, who are losing, continue to lose.
So what should be the story for this time of the Rona? And, you know, I think that there's a conversation to be had here, because there's been a lot of cuts at this story where, as it relates to Black communities and why there are more cases of coronavirus in Black communities and why Black communities are dying more from the coronavirus. Some have tried to address this problem by really talking about it as a question of individual and personal responsibility. If only Black people were healthier, and if only Black people would take care of our health, then perhaps we wouldn't be so susceptible to these kinds of viruses. Give us a real-time example. How might you reframe that conversation to talk about the systemic roots of why there are disproportionately more cases in Black communities than there may be in other communities?
Well, you know, first, I think we have to address the incentive structure, right? So people are telling Black folks to fix themselves, right? Because these health disparities are now impacting broader economic opportunity for a larger swath of people. Folks really were not worried about sort of disparities in diabetes and hypertension and heart disease and other things when they were cutting community health from Black communities. You know, so in so many ways, what we recognize is that people have placed a focus on Black people, quote unquote, fixing themselves because it's an easier story than actually having systems fix themselves. Mm. What we want to avoid, though, is having our people, the people on our side, playing into this idea that we can sort of trick ourselves into defeating systemic racism, that we can, if there's just a bunch of things that we do alone, that we will overcome the sort of 400 years of oppression in and of ourselves, because that is the presence versus power trick, right? That we sort of have a bunch of like millionaires and a few billionaires, and then we point to them as models of people breaking through, when I think that they are the exception oftentimes that proves the rule. They are the ways in which hypercapitalism doesn't actually change the sort of circumstance and dynamics. The thing about is, Alicia, both you and I know that we want the best for our people. We want our folks to be healthy. We want our folks to, you know, be able to have everything they need. And mm-hmm. we all have people in our individual lives mm-hmm. that we are probably like, damn, I wish they would just get mm-hmm. it together. Like, I wish they would, like, pull it together. There's, like, not a person of any race, probably, that doesn't have someone in their life that they're, like, family member. Otherwise, like, I wish that person would get it together. And probably if you don't have someone in your life like that, you might be that person for other people. Mm-hmm. And so I say that to say that is different, though, than a broad-based systemic failure, right, that can only be solved if we actually have broad-based systemic solutions. And so the question is, in the richest country in the world, do we believe we can do better? Or are we just going to be in a situation over and over again where we are finding Band-Aids instead of actually healing wounds? And if we're just finding Band-Aids into healing wounds, then we'll keep going on telling people that they can fix themselves inside of systems where people are being denied access to healthcare, being denied access to healthy food, being denied quality education, being denied paid sick leave, being denied all sorts of things. And then we just cheer people in major cities every night, clap for them as essential workers, and go back to doing what we were doing when we treated them like anything but essential.
You better tell this whole entire truth. So systems are on purpose. They are by design. They are not accidental, and they are not random or haphazard. And in order to change the rules, we have to change the stories that help to uphold the rules that are in place. And that includes the stories that we tell each other about each other. We got to tell different stories about each other, and we got to tell different stories about how systems function. Rashad, last question for you today. Where are you getting your inspiration? There's so much garbage going on in the world. And as fighters and as strategists, right, and as people who are organizers, it's our job, really, to provide hope. And some of us don't feel hopeful all the time. So give us some inspiration for today. What is inspiring you to keep going, even though things are tough?
So one thing that's inspired me is the unprecedented number of people that are taking action with Color of Change right now. Mm. It's inspiring that in the midst of so much pain, people feel like they want to be part of something. They want to take action. The number of people who are signing up to volunteer for our electoral program at Voting While Black is inspiring. We're seeing the numbers of people wanting to take action. You know, over 350,000 people have signed the petition to demand justice for Ahmaud Arbery, and people believe that we can direct our energy at those district attorneys and fight back. And so while fighting can sometimes, you know, be draining, I can be inspired by people's willingness to put their energy and effort behind a fight for a better tomorrow. But by believing that by coming together with other people that they can't see or touch, particularly in this moment, that we can make something new possible. And so for me, it's constantly inspiring that in the midst of pain, people want to fight and engage. And that also is part of the story of narrative work, right? We just don't want to be in stories of pain, of Black pain, of Black hurt, of Black disparity. We need to also be reminded of, you know, Black brilliance and Black joy and sort of Black aspiration, all the things that have made this country what it is, even when it is certainly not enough. Mm. The music and the food and the camaraderie. I got to do a Zoom call with my family and wish the mothers and Mother's Day that, you know, in my circle, happy Mother's Day this past weekend. You know, there's a lot that in this moment that is giving me sort of joy and hopefulness. And, you know, I guess the final thing I'll say is conversations like this one, Alicia, right, where we can move between joking about life and food and shadiness.
Yes.
And also talk about the very real issues that we are working to build power around, the rules that we are trying to change, the response. And if folks, hopefully folks will visit us at Color of Change and really join the effort to respond to COVID in an organized fashion, we can talk about all of those things inside of the same conversation and
you know, that also is, for me, deeply enriching, that we don't have to be just one thing, that we can be many things at one time.
Amen, Ashe, and hallelujah. So Rashad, don't go anywhere. We are going to come right back to you so that you can tell the people where to get in touch with you. But first, it is time for our weekly roundup of what we are going to do and what we ain't going to do. So here we go. There's a long list this week of things we just ain't going to do. So bear with me, people. Number one, install your top donor as Postmaster General. Lord have mercy on us all. A couple of weeks ago on the pod, we talked about how your president was hell-bent on privatizing the Postal Service because, you know, everything to him is like an episode of The Apprentice. Well, in a not-so-shocking turn of events, this man has installed a top donor to the Republican Party as the Postmaster General. You know, the person who runs the post office. Let's see. Everything is uncertain because of the Rona, including elections. Lots more people will have to depend on the Postal Service to vote. And some states, like California, are switching to vote by mail elections. But if your president installs their top donor as Postmaster General, who makes the rules about how the Postal Service is run, and suddenly it can cost $15 to mail your ballot in versus it being free as fuck, well, you catch my drift. Still think elections don't matter? Next on my shit list this week. I am starting to notice that wearing masks is becoming a fashion statement that is going incredibly wrong. In particular, I've been seeing more and more people wearing a mask, but around their neck while huddled close to somebody that I'm quite sure you're not quarantining with. I mean, why wear the mask at all? Why not wear it on your wrist or on your arm? How about around your ankle? My people, mi gente, my mother used to say, do it right or don't do it at all. You catch my drift? Put that thing on and leave it on every single time you leave the house and you're within 6 feet of other people. Even people you like can give you the Rona. Remember that. Number three, vigilante murders. This week was ripe with outrage about the vigilante murder of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. Ahmaud was murdered at the end of February by two family members and another man who literally ambushed him while he was jogging under the claim they thought he fit the description, air quotes here, of someone who had been breaking into homes in the area. The vigilantes were not initially arrested, of course, until all hell broke loose and groups like Color of Change were on the case. Lo and behold, what do we find? We find that the district attorney in this case was a friend of the two men who murdered Ahmaud. Needless to say, this is all just, it's all just too familiar. I'm tired of being tired, y'all. Top that off with us watching a Facebook Live where Sean Reed is murdered by two black police officers in Indianapolis after a high-speed chase where Reed, who is a veteran, was clearly in crisis. You can hear the officers saying, looks like it's going to be a closed casket, homie. Another sister was murdered during a botched police raid of her home, shot several times, and there's been no accountability. Her name was Breonna Taylor. And she was killed in Kentucky by police who were serving a search warrant for drugs, but sis had no record and the police found no drugs. Also, a black trans woman named Nina Pop was found stabbed to death in her home in Missouri last week, and she is the 10th anti-trans murder this year. The fuck, y'all? Police and vigilante murders have not ended. Meanwhile, your president offered another version of these are very good people this week in response to finally watching the video a full ass 2 weeks after it was released. He says, and I quote, according to Yahoo News, I think it's horrible and it's certainly being looked at by many people. I'm speaking to many people about it. He went on to say, in response to a reporter's question, I saw the tape, and when they moved left outside of the tape, nobody saw what was going on. It's an empty spot on the tape, I guess. We can and we should be mad, but this isn't just a terrible tragedy. It's literally the law that allows for shit like this to continue. If we're going to change the dynamic, we got to change the rules, and we got to change the people who make them. Period. The killers might be mean people or they might be your pop-pop. It doesn't matter. They have laws and legislators who protect them. Change the laws, change the legislators. Go to colorofchange.org to take action. That was deep. That was rough. That was hard. It's been a hard week. But let's go into the things that Lady likes. So here's what we love this week. Lady was loving Desus and Marrow this week. This episode with Billy Porter was giving me my whole entire ass life. Although I'm going to let y'all leave that Murder Hornet skit for another episode because Lady got questions. I'm a big fan of Billy Porter, but you know what I'm also a fan of? Straight black dudes who can give a black gay man his fucking propers. They give Mr. Porter his propers for burning down the Met Gala every year, for his long-ass career as an artist, an actor, and a singer, and for just being down as fuck. Watch the episode for this week's tutorial on how to be normal human beings. This week, Lady, want to shout out all the hetero blacks who know that it's all of us or none of us. Period. Erica Badu and Jill Scott battle on Instagram this week. Lord, there was so much in there. But needless to say, I needed that dose of black woman in my life. I was there purely for the music, not the politics. But there is something special to me about black women who come together knowing they've had the shit in the past. Maybe they still got shit today, but you know what? They're full-throated about it and they're still working to make it to the other side together. Also, thanks for bringing me back to incense and tea, trees, Vaseline, and Crown Royal on ice. I happen to be Team Erica all the way, but Jill Scott showed her stuff, and she is a formidable contender. I mean, it wasn't even really a battle. It's more like, what's your preferred taste? You drink Henny or you fucking with tequila? And lastly, I need some more Insecure in my life, not only because I am here for this storyline. I know one of the showrunners came out this week and said that there's no need to hate on Molly so much because Issa be tripping too, but let's rise above this to the real issue, which is that breaking up is hard to do, but sometimes you just gotta fucking do it. Issa and Molly have been having issues that they ain't worked out. And frankly, if you get to a point with your so-called bestie where y'all threaten to put hands on each other, it is time to call it a day. I don't think they can ever come back from this. And sometimes that's just the way it goes in my best Janet Jackson voice. I am real curious, though, about what role is Nathan finna play in the rest of this season? And for God's sake, can somebody please page Daniel? Please, page Daniel. All right. We have reached the end of our show, but I will be back here every single Friday morning to accompany you where you used to have a commute. Thank you, Mr. Robinson, for joining us.
Thank you. Tell
the good people who are listening where they can connect with you on all the socials.
So they can go to colorofchange.org or the blackresponse.org, which is our action hub for COVID-19 activism. So colorofchange.org, the blackresponse.org. Also, they can find us on all those channels, Color of Change on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And then you can follow me if you'd like at Rashad Robinson on Twitter. And I am Rashad Robinson on Instagram. All those places, you'll get more from us and hear more from us.
And you definitely need more. I know I personally cannot get enough. Don't Take No. We appreciate you joining us and we hope to see you back next week. Please connect with us and tell us what's on your mind, what you like and what you don't want to take no more of. On Twitter, we're at Lady Take. On Insta, we're at Lady Don't Take No Pod. And we're also on Facebook. We post ways to do something about the things that you hear on this show all over our social media. So if we got you amped up today, check out the socials to find out how you can take action. Please subscribe and write us a review and let the people know what you've heard here today. Our producer is Phil Circus. Our incredible theme is by Lytyrix. And this pod is supported by the Black Futures Lab. I'm your host, Alicia Garza. Remember, elections matter. Ain't no way your president ain't trying to steal this election. Put your damn mask on and quit playing. Stop killing black people and change the rules and the people who make them if you want to change results. That's right, I said it, because Lady Don't Take No.
Lady don't take no, she insists on respect the sister, walk around like a womanish. She won't speak unless it's something worse, singing don't play. The girl take herself so serious, like, people stare curious, like, she got a natural way, her hips sway furious, like, yeah, luxurious, like, there is herself, like the...
Love y'all.